The next day, Pete mustered Jethro and a couple of the hands from their work at the woodpile and led them behind the big house.
You all throw all that wood aside, then grab your shovels and start digging.
Scully stood by with his hands on his hips.
You sure you remember just where the colonel buried that bucket of money?
I remember it to my dying day. All right, y'all, start digging right about here.
Scully motioned toward the back porch. Colonel Dawkins stood there, staring.
This could be your dying day. I do believe that old man shoot you, son or not.
There was a time he would've. Something's been took out of him. Maybe it's losing the war. Maybe it's losing Mama, I don't know. He acts as mean as ever. But look in his eyes and you'll see he ain't the man he was.
I looked in his eyes. They still scared me.
Just hit a rock. Ain't nothing mowed down here.
Maybe your memory ain't as good as you thought it was.
Maybe I missed it a foot or two. Dig the hole out wider, this way.
You think you're mighty smart, Pete. But you're making a fool of yourself.
The hell I am. I saw you myself bearing the whole bucket full of Yankee money. I figured by rights it's mine because of all the work I'd done around here for nothing.
You're several months too late. I already dug it up.
What? What did you do with it?
I gave it to the cause. The Confederacy needed it to buy guns in Mexico.
Pete wanted to believe his father was lying, but he knew instinctively that he was not. Though the old man would not have spent that money on himself or any of his family, he would squander it on a lost cause.
You fool! You damn old fool!
When I saw the men start digging, I knew why you wanted to stay. You weren't content just to steal horses from me. You were gonna steal my money, too. Well, now there's nothing here for you except a lot of hard work. So when are you leaving?
That'd tickle you plumb to death, wouldn't it? But this country owes me, and one way or another I'm going to collect. If not from you, then from anywhere and anybody I can. Jethro, get that hole filled up before somebody falls in it.
Seems like there ain't much use in us staying around here.
At least we got a roof and beds and something to eat. And I found out the old dog barks loud but ain't got any teeth left. So we'll stay. Even a blind hog finds him an acorn now and then.
We ain't blind hogs.
So there's no telling what acorns we may find.
Every day or two, tired and hungry ex-soldiers stopped by Rusty's farm. Most had not been released officially. They'd simply declared themselves finished with war and had struck out on their own without a by your leave. They were ragged, hungry, and afoot. Too proud to ask outright for a meal, but grateful for anything offered. Some were making their way to homes farther along. Some had found that they no longer had a home and were looking for a place where they might start afresh. Open country to the west offered land almost free for the taking if a man were willing to accept the challenge of low rainfall, few neighbors, and the risk of Indian raids. No matter where they came from, the refugees carried essentially the same reports. Hard times had fallen upon Texas with a vengeance. Confederate money would buy nothing, and Yankee money had long ago been spent. Commerce, what little there was, had to be conducted on a barter basis. Local governments were, for the most part, in a state of collapse. Rusty gave what he could to the transients, grateful not to be among them. The cabin was reserved for Clemmy Monahan and her two younger daughters. Rusty and Grandpa Vince Purdy slept beneath a shed out beside the barn. Soldiers were welcome to spend the night beneath that roof. If they were too tired to go on, they were given welcome to stay and rest. At least there was food. The spring-planted garden was yielding vegetables. Beef was plentiful and without monetary value because cattle had run free and mostly unclaimed during the war, multiplying without limits beyond those imposed by drought and the available grazing. He had known the Monahan family would not remain indefinitely. They had come seeking refuge from Caleb Dawkins's violent fanaticism. That danger had ended with the war. For a while now, Clemmy had been saying they should soon return to their own farm to piece together whatever remnants they could find of their past lives. Each time Rusty saw her step out onto the dog run and look hopefully to the northwest, he knew she was looking for her son, James. It was raining the night he came. Rusty had been watching the darkening clouds during the afternoon, fearing they might pass over without shedding a drop, or at least more than a light shower. But weather was unpredictable. Drought or flood, anything was possible. The farmer's life was always subject to the vagaries of wind, rain, and sunshine. Coming in from the field, he saw the two girls harvesting vegetables in the garden, holding them in their aprons, carrying them to baskets set at the end of the rows. Sometimes their sudden appearance caught him off guard and gave him a start, making him think of Geneva, especially Josie, who looked the most like her older sister. Josie came to meet him at the garden gate, her long hair blown by the wind.
Looks like we're fixing to get a frog-strangling rain. We thought we'd better gather what we could.
I'll pitch in and help you.
We'd like that.
An hour or so later, they were seated at the supper table. The cabin door had been closed against the damp wind that came with the rain.
Hello there. Room for another at the table?
James! Is that real?
Oh, easy there, Mama. I'm soaked. Don't want you to catch a cold.
Oh, we've been praying for this day.
I wish I prayed for dry weather. A wagon like to have bogged down, and I'm wet to the hide.
His gaze drifted to Rusty. A little of his old reserve remained, but he still smiled.
I do appreciate you giving the folks a place to live for so long.
The whole outfit might have dried up and blowed away if they hadn't been here. They took good care of things while I was away.
I'm glad you got past the brush men, all right. Some of them turned kind of peevish when they found out you'd slipped away.
How was that Oldham boy when you left camp?
Alive, but not kicking much. His brother wanted me to tell him where you live. I told him I thought you was somewhere over by the Trinity River.
Quite a long way from the Colorado.
That it is.
Thanks. I don't want any more trouble with him. I wasn't looking for the trouble I already had.
Oh, you two can catch up later. The war's been over for a right smart while. Where have you been all this time?
Up at our old place, helping Geneva and Evan build you a new house. It's finished, Mama, and waiting for you. For all of you. Anytime you're ready to go.
Oh, we've been ready for the longest time. Oh, this place has been good to us, and Rusty's been more than generous. But it ain't the same as home.
The new house ain't as fine as the one Caleb Dawkins burned down. But it'll keep the rain off your head.
Is the old cabin still standing, or did Caleb Dawkins go back and burn it?
It's still there, such as it is. Geneva and Evan been living in it. Have you heard from Geneva lately?
Ain't been any mail since I don't know when.
She's in a family way.
Oh.
Wanna make a grandmother of you before the snow flies?
I'll be right back.
Rusty walked out onto the dog run, watching rain pound the hard-packed ground and runoff water move in small brown rivulets down toward the swelling creek. He stopped beneath the edge of the roof and felt the wind-blown spray wetting his face. He shook, suddenly cold, and wished the rain could wash away the grief that came with the slow dying of old dreams. He was still on the dog run, sitting on a bench, when James finished his supper and came out to join him. James stood beside him, looking out into the rain.
Back there in that brush camp, you could have told me Geneva was married.
I never got around to it. We had other things pressing on us, remember? Pretty soon you were gone.
I never thought but what she'd wait for me.
She hadn't heard from you in a long time. For all she knew, you were dead.
I wrote to her. The letters never got through.
You ought to have found a way to come and see her, even if you had to desert the Rangers. But you didn't. And Evan came along looking like he was fixing to die. Geneva cared for him like a nurse. Well, you know how it is. A man and a woman together so much. You weren't here, and he was. Nature just took its course.
Rusty doubled a fist. The war, the damned war, it cost everybody far too much.
Evan works hard. He loves her, and he makes her smile. For a long time, she didn't have much to smile about.
The war was hell on everybody, even those who never went to it. Sooner or later, it came to them.
Monahan sure suffered their share.
It may be hard on Clemmy, going back where so many sorrowful things happened.
It'll pass. She's got a will like an iron hammer. Your feelings for Geneva will pass too, if you let them.
I figured on asking her to marry me.
Well, when a man really wants to do something, he ought to go ahead and do it. Time has a way of taking things away from you if you wait too long.
So I found out.
I used to lie awake nights thinking about killing Caleb Dawkins. But I decided that was too quick and easy for what he's done. So I'm letting him wait and sweat over what I'm going to do and when I'm going to do it.
What are you going to do?
Nothing. Just let him worry himself to death. That way the revenge will last longer.
James went back into the kitchen side of the cabin. In a little while, Josie came out. Her shoulders were slumped, her eyes downcast.
I thought you'd be happier seeing your brother.
He's come to take us home.
That's what you've been waiting for, ain't it?
It's what Mama's been wanting, and Alice and Grandpa. But I like it here.
Nothing is as good as home.
Too much happened there. Too many bad things. Everything here has been good, till now.
She turned toward him, her eyes sad. At this moment, she looked more than ever like Geneva.
You don't want us to leave, do you, Rusty?
I've got used to having you all on the place. It'll be lonesome when everybody's gone. But I guess it had to happen sometime.
I'd rather stay here. You'll need somebody to cook for you and sew and keep the garden.
I'm afraid Clemmy would never stand still for such as that. You a young woman, me a man. It'd give folks an awful lot to gossip about.
It wouldn't be anybody's business.
That's when people really talk, when it's none of their business.
Presently, James and his grandfather returned to the dog run. The rain seemed to be slacking off. That suited Rusty. He'd rather not have so much that it drowned out part of the field.
First thing come morning, me and Grandpa start gathering up our horses.
When the Monahan women and Vince Purdy had moved to Rusty's place to wait out the war, they'd brought their band of mares with them. Unattended at the deserted Monahan home place, the whole bunch would have disappeared in short order. As it was, their numbers had increased.
Young'un, you got no idea how much trouble we had holding on to them. Army horse buys keep sniffing around. They're worse than the damn Injuns. They offer Confederate scrip that everybody knowed wasn't worth a bucket of cold spit. At least the Comanches never bothered trying to lie to us. They just taken what they could and went on their way. Me and Clemmy let the buyers take a few snides now and again, but we managed to keep the best of the bunch head out to the west of here. We go to talking about Injuns. No government people ever got the nerve to venture out that far.
I've seen where most of the mares are running. I'll help you round them up.
You got work of your own to do, but we'd be obliged.
And I'll help you move your folks back home. I'll go along with you.
We couldn't impose on you that far.
I'm thinking of the risk. Don't you think it was kind of dangerous, you coming down here all by yourself?
During the war, I traveled by myself a plenty of times to visit the folks. And I had conscript officers and sheriffs looking to catch me. Now, I don't have to fret about them no more.
There's always a chance of running into Indians.
Done that, too. I always had a faster horse than they did.
This time you came in a wagon. What if you all ran across Indians on your way home? You couldn't outrun them. How long would you last in a fight? Just two men and three women?
Long enough to do them some damage. One more man would help the odds. If you think this farm can get along without you, we'd be tickled to have you come with us.
The fields are gonna be too wet to work anyway.
The younger of the girls rode with her mother on the wagon James had brought. Josie rode on horseback alongside Rusty and her brother James, driving the mares, colts, and a bay stallion. Vince Purdy drove a second wagon, piled high with family belongings. It was one the Monahans had brought with them when they fled Caleb Dawkins. Rusty had not heard of any Indian incursions in a while, but the possibility could never be dismissed. Another potential problem was the defeated ex-soldiers straggling across the country. Most were harmless, but some were hungry, frustrated, and desperate enough to do almost anything. Tom Blessing had told Rusty about a couple of murders supposedly committed in the course of robbery. He would deny it even to himself, but one reason Rusty had volunteered to join the Monahans on this trip was that he burned to see Geneva. He realized that seeing her might hurt worse than not seeing her. Still, the compulsion was too strong to put down. He could rationalize that the family needed the extra protection his presence would afford. But in some secret corner of his mind, he knew that was not his primary reason for going. He caught James studying him critically, and he suspected Geneva's brother saw into that secret corner. The first day passed without incident. The mares and colts had to be held back, limited by the lumbering pace of the wagons. They would move well ahead, then the riders would stop and loose herd them to graze until the wagons caught up. Josie rode a side saddle belonging to her mother.
You sit real good on that thing.
I rode with Grandpa Vince a lot, looking after the mares. Till Evan came, I was Grandpa's main outside help.
Except when Preacher Webb stopped by or James slipped past the law to spend a day or two with us.
Her face was deeply tanned, for she had spent a lot of time in the sun and wind. Rusty had seen her ride horseback and maneuver a plow, though he had noted that she knew her way around the kitchen, too. A Texas farm woman, or girl, was expected to be able to work like a man without forgetting she wasn't one.
Looks to me like you can do whatever you set your mind to.
I was hoping you'd see that.
The procession was nearing the Monahan home place when Rusty saw two horsemen a few hundred yards ahead. The pair quickly moved into the cover of nearby brush.
James?
I saw them. Josie, you get back with the wagons. Tell Mom and Grandpa to keep their eyes open. Be ready to run for that ravine yonder.
Right. Indians, you reckon?
We'll find out pretty soon. We'll hold the mares here till the wagons catch up.
Rusty and James brought the mares and colts to a stop, but did not let them spread out to graze. Rusty drew his rifle from its scabbard and placed it in front of him. He watched the brush for a moment. It came, finally. The two figures, realizing they'd been spotted, emerged into the open.
Huh. At least it ain't Indians.
Can't say I'm happy to see them, though.
We're gonna go up on ahead and meet them.
Stay safe, son.
These guys ain't no problem.
James and Rusty intercepted the two riders.
Why, if it ain't Caleb Dawkins' son. Army treat you well?
Thought at first you all might be Indians with stolen horses. Wanted to add ours to the bunch. Then we saw the wagons and no different. Now that I see who you are, I almost wish you had been Indians.
Rusty recognized the second rider as Scully, who had been with Pete when the Rangers caught them stealing horses. Pete hungrily studied the Monahan mares. The thought behind his eyes was easy to read.
People been telling me the country is near stripped of horses. That's a likely-looking bunch of mares and colts you got.
We've got them, and we're keeping them.
Ain't you afraid some slick-fingered Comanches might run off with them?
All the slick fingers don't belong to Comanches. I remember the day we caught you two with some horses you forgot to pay for.
An honest mistake. We misread the brands.
These all carry the Monahan brand, big enough for a blind man to see.
Scully had not spoken. He seemed content to let Pete do the talking. Rusty judged him to be a follower. He would follow Pete all the way to hell if that was the direction Pete chose to go. It probably would be, sooner or later.
You still a ranger?
There are no rangers as far as I know. The outfit broke up.
Ain't that a shame? Won't be no laws around to beat up on us hard-working farm boys.
There's still guns and there's still rope. You remember about rope, don't you, Pete?
Pete's smile died as quickly as it had come.
Since we won't have any regular law, it'll be up to all of us to administer justice according to our own lights. I remember the way the Dawkinses did it.
You threatening me, Monahan?
Just letting you know I've got a long memory. Now, if you're through visiting, we've still got a ways to go.
Pete pulled aside, and Scully trailed after him like a pup. Rusty and James set the mares to moving. Rusty turned in the saddle, making certain Pete and Scully didn't follow.
I didn't like the way Pete was looking at your horses.
I did. First time he makes a try for them, he's liable to disappear off the face of the earth. And everybody will wonder what went with him.
Everybody but you.
Everybody but me.
Maybe it's just as well I'm not a ranger anymore. I'd hate to be the one sent to take you in.
I'd hate it too. I wouldn't like having you on my conscience.
The Monahan's new house was simple, constructed of logs, and built in the traditional double-cabin fashion with an open dog run between the sections, much like Rusty's own. Clemmy's reaction could not have been more enthusiastic if it had been the governor's mansion. She leaned forward on the wagon seat, straining to see better.
We're home, children.
Josie sat on her horse beside Rusty's Alamo. She had contrived to ride near him most of the trip.
We're not children. At least I'm not.
She was not, though Rusty thought she would probably always seem that way to her mother. She was blossoming into a handsome young woman. Rusty looked hopefully toward the open dog run, thinking Geneva might walk out to greet her mother and sisters. He burned to see her, but the only person he saw was a man he realized must be her husband. Evan Gifford opened the corral gate to receive the mares, then strove toward the wagons with a hand raised in welcome.
You'll like Evan.
Rusty doubted it.
You all light and hitch.
Gifford raised his arms to help his mother-in-law and then Alice down from the wagon. Rusty studied him, hoping to find something to dislike, but seeing nothing beyond the fact that he had won Geneva while Rusty was busy elsewhere. Gifford appeared to be about Rusty's own age. The effects of war showed in his face, in the seriousness of his eyes. A narrow scar across his right cheekbone could have resulted from a saber slash or a bullet. If a bullet, Rusty thought, why could it not have been an inch farther in? He immediately felt guilty. Such a thought was unworthy of him. He wished no one dead, least of all a soldier who fought for his country. Clemmy looked around worriedly.
Where's Geneva? There's nothing wrong with her, is there?
Oh, she's in the cabin taking a rest. Been having some low days. Preacher Webb says it's normal, what with her condition.
Preacher's here?
In yonder with Geneva.
Clemmy turned toward the older structure which Geneva and her husband had made their home. It had been the Monahan family's first dwelling years ago, replaced eventually by a larger house.
Don't you want to look at your new home first?
It'll still be there when I'm ready. I need to see after my daughter. Geneva, we're here.
A little help, Rusty?
Huh? Oh, sure, Josie.
Smiling her appreciation, she clung to Rusty's arm longer than necessary, then followed her mother and sister.
I'll send the mares to the corral.
You sure Geneva's all right?
Preacher don't seem worried. Neighbor lady's been coming over regular. Geneva do better now that she's got her family around her. She's missed them.
Man, we missed her. You two get caught up now. I'm going to see my granddaughter.
Rusty offered a handshake.
I'm Rusty Shannon.
Pleased to meet you. Geneva and her folks have spoken of you. I already know a lot about you.
I never knew about you till just a little while back. Ever since I got home, Clemmy's been itching to get back here and pick up where she left off.
Well, nothing will ever be the same as it was. But she'll bow her neck and make the best of what there is. These Monahans are a strong-minded bunch.
I know for certain that James is. We came across Pete Dawkins. He been by here, him or his daddy?
No, they've taken wide roundings of this place. James let it be known that he wasn't looking for trouble, but if any came at him, he'd go meet it halfway. Everybody knew he was talking about the Dawkinses. I imagine the word got to them.
Pete gave the mares a long and hungry look.
Well, if any turn up missing, me and James will know where to look first, and we better not find them there.
Rusty sensed that there was no false bravado in Gifford. He meant what he said. That was a strong point in his favor.
I owe the Monahans a lot. You have any idea what it means to not have anybody? No family, nobody?
I do. It happened to me.
Army sent me home so shot up they thought I'd die. But I found I didn't have a home to go back to. Ma and Pa both passed away. My only sister had sold the place. Then she took down with the fever and she was gone too. I was like a lost child till the Monahans took me in, nursed me like I was their own, got me back on my feet.
Old Colonel Dawkins had killed Lon and Billy. Like as not, you filled an empty space for the family.
They sure filled an empty space for me. I have a notion you and Geneva were sort of close. Close enough for marrying?
We never talked about that. Anyway, it was a long time ago, before you came. That's over and forgotten about.
I'd like to have you for a friend, Rusty, but I need to know I've got no reason to worry.
You don't.
Though his heart was not in it, Rusty extended his hand again. Gifford took it, then beckoned with his head.
Come on, let's go in. Geneva's had time to say hi to her folks by now.
The bedroom half of the cabin was separated from the kitchen side by an opening over which a common roof extended. Rusty followed Gifford through the narrow door. He steeled himself, not sure what his feelings would be when he saw Geneva. She sat on the edge of a bed, tinier than he had remembered, though her stomach was visibly extended. Alice was brushing out Geneva's long hair. Clemmy and Purdy had pulled wooden chairs up close. Geneva's features were as fine as he remembered. He thought her face looked pale, but it was hard to be sure because the room was semi-dark. Rusty felt warmth rise in his face, and for a moment he wished he had not come.
Welcome back, Rusty.
She extended her small hand. Hesitant to take it, he held it gently, as if it were an eggshell. She seemed frail.
You look mighty good.
He felt anew the aching sense of loss. It used to be easy to talk with her. Now he felt awkward, especially with her husband standing beside her.
He saw a look of affection pass between the two and wished for some excuse to leave this crowded room. The air seemed close and hard to breathe.
Rusty, when I didn't hear from you for so long, I thought you were probably dead. We heard about some awful Indian fights.
There were some rangers killed, but none of them were me.
He realized too late how unnecessary that sounded. For the first time, he noticed Preacher Webb standing back in a corner. Rusty suspected Webb was aware of his discomfort, for after a minute, the minister placed a hand on Rusty's shoulder.
It's been a while since I ministered to my flock down your way. I hope sin is not broken loose amongst the lambs.
Well, not so much that a sermon or two wouldn't fix it.
It's time I went back down there. I may ride with you when you're ready to go.
It'd please me to have your company. Geneva, I know you've got a jot of family visiting to do. I'd best go see after my horse.
Don't be in a hurry to leave.
He saw nothing to stay for. He'd come mostly because of a compulsion to see her again. Now he had seen her, and it still hurt as badly as not seeing her. The minister followed him out onto the dog run. He looked back to see if anyone might hear.
Maybe you oughtn't to have come. It's like picking at an old sore after it's healed over. Or has it healed?
One reason I came was to find out. And I guess it hasn't.
There's times a man has got to turn loose of what's past, no matter how bad it hurts.
I know. I'm leaving here come daylight tomorrow morning.
I'll ride with you, Rusty. It'll be like old times.
Nothing would ever again be like old times, but Rusty was grateful for whatever part of them he could salvage. He thought of the occasions in his youth when he had ridden with Warren Webb on the minister's preaching circuit.
I'd be tickled to have your company.
You're both leaving so soon? I do wish y'all wouldn't hurry away. We just barely got here.
Well, Rusty's got work to do at home, and I've got sheep wandering around looking for their shepherd. Figured we'd stop by Blessings on the way, see how his time's been spent.
Clemmy took the minister's hand.
You've got a flock here that loves to see you come and hates to see you go. You'll always be welcome too, Rusty. You made your home ours for a long time. Now our home is yours.
I'm obliged.
Rusty thought he would probably wait a while. Maybe someday he could look at Geneva without aching inside. He was tightening the cinch on his saddle when Evan Gifford came around from behind Alamo, looking for a chance to speak without anyone else hearing.
I know you're concerned about Geneva, so am I. But Preach says he thinks she'll be all right. So it's pretty much normal being her first baby.
Preacher's a good doctor.
Rusty, I can tell by the way you looked at her there, there's a lot of deep feeling. So I want you to know that I love her, that I'll never hurt her, and she'll never have no reason to shed a tear over anything I do.
Well, nobody could ask for more than that. I hope you both live for 100 years, and every year is better than the one before it. She made a good choice.
Thank you, Rusty. I'll let you get back to your work.
Preacher Webb had been close enough to hear.
I know it hurt to say that. It takes a strong man sometimes to recognize the truth and to speak it.
Then let's be getting started while I'm still feeling strong. Josie!
She stood in the open gate. Rusty saw tears in her eyes.
I wish you'd stay, but I know you can't.
She glanced back toward Geneva, who stood in the dog run of the older cabin.
I'll be back one of these days, Josie.
I know you will. Because one of these days I'm gonna marry you, Rusty Shannon.
Preacher Webb gave Rusty a quizzical look.
She's too young to know her own mind.
She's a Monahan. Monahans are born knowing their minds.
James and Vince had turned the mares out of the corral at daybreak. Rusty and Webb rode through them as they scattered, the older mares seeking out remembered, favored grazing places, the younger ones exploring their new range. Rusty caught sight of two horsemen a quarter mile away. The pair were standing still. Webb saw them too. He squinted hard.
Maybe they're soldiers working their way home.
A little too far to see clearly, but I know those horses' colors. That'd be Pete Dawkins and his running mate, probably hatching a scheme to make a run at the Monahan mares some dark night.
Maybe we should go back and tell James.
James already knows. We ran into Pete on our way up here.
The Monahans have already suffered too much at the hands of the Dawkins family.
I have a notion it's the Dawkins' turn to suffer at the hands of James Monahan.
Yeah.
The people of this Comanche band knew him as Badger Boy because he had a badger's belligerent response when other boys picked on him. And pick on him they had in the beginning, for he seemed a misfit among those near his own age. His eyes were blue, where theirs were brown or black, his skin lighter than theirs. He had found that the best way to stop others from bedeviling him was to hit back stronger than he was struck, resorting to a preemptive strike from time to time to keep his tormentors off balance. Gradually, they had learned to show him respect, though it was obvious that he had not been born of the people. He had only hazy recollections of a time when he was not living among the Comanches. He was dimly aware, more from stories heard than from things remembered, that he'd been taken in a raid on a Taibo settlement when he was no more than 4 or 5 summers old. He remembered his Comanche father, known as Buffalo Caller. No one spoke that name anymore, because it was the way of the people not to voice the names of the dead, lest their spirits be disturbed. He vaguely remembered a Texan father and mother. The years had all but erased any memory of what they looked like or anything they had said. Yet buried somewhere deep in his subconsciousness was a faint memory of raw terror that came to him now and again as in a dream. He knew within reason that his white parents had been killed, for they would not otherwise have yielded him up. None of the people had ever told him anything of his origins. He sometimes wished he could recall more. That remembered fear rose up as a barrier, blocking him from probing deeper into the dark shadows of his past. Buffalo Caller had taken him as a son, but all too soon had died a warrior's death at the hands of the Rangers. Steel's the Ponies had shouldered the responsibility of becoming both brother and father to the boy. He had taught Badger Boy how to make a boy-sized bow and the arrows that went with it, how to ride, how to hunt. He had refined the youngster's fighting skills, though most had come instinctively as a defense against other boys tempted to taunt an outsider. Now they stepped aside rather than face his fists, or sometimes a leather quirt or heavy stick, whatever he could lay his hands on. Older people often said within his hearing that he might well become the fiercest warrior of them all, but they added that he had to wait, to bide his time and get his full growth. He thought he'd waited long enough. He had listened to his brother and other young warriors make plans for a raid on the Texan settlements, and he wanted to go.
You come with us. Your legs are still too short. You could not keep up.
But you will be riding, not walking. My legs are long enough for riding a war pony.
A short-legged pony, perhaps.
I would not fall behind. If I do, you can leave me. I can find the way by myself.
The Texans would laugh at us. They would say the people must have no warriors left if they bring a boy on a mission of war.
I hear that Mexican Talker is going. He's only this much taller than me.
Badger Boy made a gesture with both hands to illustrate the small difference. Mexican Talker, like himself, had been brought into the band as a captive, taken as a boy in a raid on a Mexican village. He was dark-skinned and black-eyed, so that strangers looking upon him could easily assume he was Comanche by blood. Only when he spoke would they know otherwise, because he still had the accent of one who had learned another language first. Badger Boy had a bit of the same problem. A few words never came out quite the way he intended. People said it was because of his Texan birth.
Mexican Talker is older than you. He has made his quest and found his medicine. No, Badger Boy, you must wait a while longer.
Badger Boy reluctantly conceded to himself that his brother would not allow him to ride out with the others when they invaded the white man's settlements. So Badger Boy began planning how he would slip out of the encampment and go anyway. Tom Blessing wondered how much legal authority the sheriff had since the breakup of the Confederacy. But Tom Blessing's challenging presence bespoke authority, whether backed by law or not. He had only to walk into a crowd to draw its full attention. Rusty had not visited the settlement since his return home. Physically, it had not changed much. It was a farming community with a plain 2-story stone courthouse, a cotton gin, a general store, and 3 dram shops. The dirt streets were quiet, though he noticed an unusual number of men loafing in front of the store, the saloons, and a blacksmith shop. Some wore remnants of Confederate uniforms. Most had a hungry look, for they had come back from the war to find employment scarce and money scarcer. A couple of strangers gave him a hostile stare for no good reason he could think of, except perhaps that he seemed to carry purpose, and they had none. To a barefoot man, the owner of an old pair of boots appears rich. He had ridden first by the Blessing farm, where Mrs. Blessing had told him her husband was in town. Rusty entered the sheriff's office. The high windows were open, but the breeze outside was not strong enough to carry through the room. The place was oppressively warm.
Rusty! Welcome back!
Well, thanks, Tom.
I hope you brought a few dollars to town, Rusty. This place ain't been blessed with fresh money in 6 months.
I haven't got 10 cents.
If somebody was to spend $100 in Yankee silver, it'd circulate from one hand to another and wipe out most of the town's debts before dark.
Sorry. How are things?
Well, there's been a little to do out at the York place.
Shanty?
Yeah.
What happened?
Heard that some fellers rode over there last night.
You okay?
Heard he was messed up a bit, but it was just a warning.
A warning? Of what?
Rusty, you and I both know the answer to that. Ever since Isaac left in that place, I've been afraid of something like this.
What are you gonna do about it?
I could camp out at Shanty Shack and hold off trouble for a while, but I couldn't stay forever. It's just one of me. They'd wait me out and hit him after I left.
What's the use in having law if it can't be enforced?
I'm not sure how much law there is. Governor Murrah has gone south to Mexico and taken a bunch of state officials with him. He figured when the Yankee troops move in, they'd put him in irons. Like as not, they would. For all I know, they may come and put me in irons.
Well, till they do, you're still sheriff.
Even if I throw somebody in jail, I couldn't take a case to trial. I don't think the Federals recognize any Texas courts right now.
Kind of like having an empty gun and no shells.
It's quiet here compared to some places. There's been riots in Austin and San Antonio, places like that. A lot of soldiers came home with empty pockets and feel they got a right to take whatever they feel like taking. Been folks killed, fighting over property that don't amount to a damn.
The Confederate government never paid much attention to us out here except for the conscript officers. Maybe the Yankees won't either.
We won't know where we stand till they move in and take over.
We may not like it.
It's what we get for losing the war.
It never was my war in the first place, Rusty thought. He knew Blessing had felt allegiance to the Confederacy, so he did not give voice to what was in his mind.
This still doesn't answer what we're going to do about Shanty.
You were a ranger, Rusty. A good one, from everything I saw and what I've heard. How do you feel about being a deputy sheriff?
You just said you don't have much authority left. A deputy would have even less.
Blessing walked to a wooden rack attached to the wall. He selected a rifle and lifted it out.
Even if the government goes all to pieces, and it might, there's still authority in this.
I don't know.
The rifle is yours if you want it. I doubt you'll ever get any cash wages.
When I was a ranger, I got paid mighty seldom and mighty little. But why would I want to be a deputy sheriff?
For one thing, there's Shanty. In case of trouble, the back of my office might keep you out of jail.
Huh. I wouldn't want to be away from my farm too much.
I'm at mine most of the time.
All right, then. Yeah, I'll do it.
Good. I got a badge from a county over in Arkansas. If anybody gives you trouble, just flash it real quick. That's yours now. Anything you feel like you need to do, tell them I told you to.
Well, thanks.
No problem. Oh, and Rusty?
Yeah?
Good luck.
Rusty reined Alamo toward the field. Seeing them, Shanty appeared apprehensive. He reined the plow mule to a stop and took off his hat, lifting and holding it to shade his face and block out the sun's glare. He looked ready to turn and run. Recognizing the visitors, he seemed to relax, but not by much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Preacher. Mr. Rusty?
Rusty saw an ugly welt across Shanty's dark face. It appeared to have been left by a quirt or a whip.
Yeah. We're here to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Shanty blinked as fear came into his dark eyes.
I'm all right. Ain't nothing been done that won't heal.
With thumb and forefinger on Shanty's chin, Webb turned the black man's head one way, then the other, examining the mark closely.
That cut deep enough to bring blood. Have you put anything on it?
Some bacon grease with a touch of salt in it. That's all I had.
Anybody would do a thing like that?
Oh, they just figured to scare me some is all. And I reckon they done that.
Warned you to get off this place?
Yeah, that seemed to be the main thing on their mind. Said I don't belong here. and if I don't want something worse than that whip, I'd better leave. But I got nowhere to go.
This place belongs to you fair and square. They've got no right to run you off.
Rights don't matter when the devil's at work. Don't forget what happened to Lon and Billy Monahan.
Tom Blessing's the law, and now I'm his deputy. We're gonna stay here and make sure this doesn't happen again.
I thank you, gentlemen. I surely do. But I got crops here and a few critters to see after. I can't just be going off and leaving them.
It's dangerous for you here till we get this thing squashed.
Ain't nothing happens without the Lord's will. I talked to him about it.
You're dealing with people who don't spend much time listening to the Lord. But they'll listen to me or pay the price. Who were they, Shanty?
They came at night, had their faces covered.
I'll bet Fowler Gaskin was amongst them.
Like I said, I didn't see no faces. I wouldn't want to bear false witness against nobody. The commandments is plain on that.
Damn cowards. Whipping an old man that can't afford to defend himself. Let's see them try and whip me.
Better get a hold of yourself. The mood you're in, you might shoot somebody.
I wouldn't want nobody killed on my account. This little old place ain't worth that.
Rusty realized Webb was right. In his present state, he might just shoot somebody. He had come frighteningly close once with Isaac York, and he would have done it the night the Monahans were lynched if he could have reached Caleb Dawkins. On both occasions, he had felt chilled afterward, realizing how near he had come to doing murder.
Let's all just cool down and enjoy the day. Come nighttime, we'll see if your temper needs rising.
Rusty and Webb spent the evening sitting outside Shanty's house. Two men had come within a couple of hundred yards and stopped to look, but just rode right on.
Ain't nothing gonna happen till dark, I'd bet. Come on, Shanty's fixing us a little meal.
Hello there, Rusty. See anything?
Not yet.
I don't see why anybody troubled themselves over this little old place. It barely growed enough to make a living for me and Mr. Isaac.
Rusty saw no tactful way to explain that the land itself was not the issue, but rather the fact that it was owned by a black, a former slave. He suspected Shanty knew the real reason he was being harassed, but was trying to deny it to himself.
These are mean times. There's people who would kill a man for a pair of shoes, much less a farm.
Well, I'll be all right. Ain't no need for you all putting yourselves out on my account.
Well, that's fine. But me and Preacher will sleep in the shed. It's too late to go back to my place tonight.
But that's fine. We'll be having something to eat directly.
Shanty fed his guests and passed the time with them through the evening.
You play mighty well, Shanty.
Well, thanks. Always did like to play. Helps me relax.
Hold on. You hear that? Horses coming our way.
I suppose it means trouble.
I don't remember the last time anybody brought me good news at this hour of the night.
Rusty picked up the rifle Tom Blessing had given him.
Shanty, if there's any shooting, lay flat on the floor. Whatever you do, don't come outdoors. Webb, you got a gun?
I prefer to use the word.
If these are the same old boys that whipped Shanty before, they ain't likely to listen to no sermons. They'll pay attention to this rifle.
For a minute or so, Rusty did not hear the horses moving. He wondered if he might have been wrong, that the riders might simply have been travelers passing by. Then he saw several small points of fire bobbing around.
What in the world?
They lighted torches. They intend to burn this cabin.
Rusty counted six horsemen and a man on a mule. He thought on Len Tanner, who would have liked these odds. He wished he had the fight-loving Tanner at his side just then, instead of the peaceable Preacher Webb.
Preacher Webb? You ready to use that?
I said I prefer to use the word, but sometimes you have to get their attention before they'll listen.
Let's get it!
They fixing to kill me?
They can fix it, do whatever they want. Nothing's happening tonight.
Rusty wondered that he felt no fear. Instead, his earlier anger returned, rising like a brush fire. He lifted the rifle to his shoulder. He waited until the leading horse was 50 feet away. The stricken horse tumbled to the ground, tossing its rider almost in front of Rusty.
Come here! I'm ready to use this pistol. The rest of you stop where you're at, or I'll splatter his brains all over you, if he's got any.
Who the hell are you?
I'm a deputy sheriff, and I'm placing all of you under arrest.
It was a bluff. If they decided to ride him down, they could do it in an instant. But about one thing, he was not bluffing. He hoped they believed he would blow the lead rider's brains out, because he meant it. Rusty saw a whip tied to the downed horse's saddle. He knew it was intended for Shanty. He had no time for regret over killing the horse. He had shot Indian mounts to set their riders afoot. A horse was a surer target than the man on its back. Remorse could trouble him later when he had leisure to indulge in it. The men still in the saddle hesitated, uncertain. All wore sacks over their heads with holes punched to see through.
You think you can stop us all by yourself?
He's not by himself.
Preacher? Who the hell told you to butt in? This ain't Sunday meeting.
I declared war on Satan a long time ago, and it's his work you're about tonight.
Well, we didn't come here to do battle with a preacher, or even a deputy sheriff. It's got nothing to do with you. We come to put a nigger in his place.
We're all children of God. Shanty no less than the rest of us. A hand raised against him is a hand raised against a child of God.
Oh, we didn't come here to listen to no preaching. We came to do a job. Are you gonna let us do it?
Hey, you don't think I'll shoot him?
Pull us back off. He'll kill me, sure.
As sure as hell. Now, whatever guns you've got, drop them on the ground.
The men looked at one another, each waiting for someone else to start.
Well, don't you let that finger twitch on that trigger, deputy. That's my cousin you got there.
All the men dropped their weapons, all but the mule's rider. Rusty jerked the sack from the head of the man he'd been holding. He recognized the face, though the name would not come to him.
The rest of you, take off those hoods. I want to look at you.
The man on the mule wheeled about and beat a hasty retreat. Rusty knew the mule. He had seen Fowler Gaskin riding it lately. It was like Gaskin to start a fight, then step back and let others take the consequences. Most of the men who remained were strangers to Rusty.
Do you know him, preacher?
Most of them.
Webb looked regretfully at the leader, who still had the muzzle of Rusty's pistol near his ear.
I'm sorry to see you here, Jedediah Hoskins. As many times as we prayed together, I thought better of you.
Well, I didn't know most of you before, but I'll know all of you next time. Hoskins, go join your cousin.
Hey, since when did the law go siding with niggers?
Black or white, right is right and wrong is wrong. It doesn't make any difference. It
makes a difference to us. You can't be here all the time, deputy. We'll be coming back.
If you do, I'll know who to go looking for.
What about our guns?
I'll sack them up and take them to Tom Blessing. When you work up the nerve, you can get them from him.
Hoskins frowned over his dead mount.
That was a good horse. It'll be hard to find another.
It was either him or you. I figured you'd rather it was him.
Hoskins retrieved the saddle and mounted behind his cousin. He looked back angrily as they rode away.
We didn't make any friends here tonight.
I don't need friends like them anyway. Who was the feller I had a hold of?
Jed Hoskins. He and his cousin Mordecai took up farms to the south, yonder a ways. It was after you went up to Fort Belknap.
I want to remember them too.
Shanty had ventured outside. He gave the dead horse a moment's sad scrutiny.
Pity for an innocent animal to die like that.
Might have been better to have shot the man who was on him. But there would have been all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, I know. Best that I be going. But this is home. Won't no other place ever be the same.
I told you before, you can stay with me. It's not far. We can ride over here and work your farm together. I'll help you with your fields, and you can help me with mine.
That'd be a kindness, but you don't owe me nothing.
I owe Isaac. Since you're his only heir, I owe you.
Well, in that case, I'll tote my share of the load, and that's gospel.
I know you'll do fine. Just fine.
Let me just pack some things. Be all right if I fetch my old guitar along? I'll try not to be a bother with it.
Bring it. That cabin could stand to hear some music.
Steele's ponies and his companions made plenty of noise about their pre-dawn leaving. They had no qualms about awakening the entire camp. On the contrary, they wanted everyone to know. A major benefit of being a warrior was the acclaim one received. Reticence was not a virtue among fighting men. Badger Boy watched his brother and the others mount their war horses in the pale light that preceded sunrise. Steele's the ponies rode over to him and leaned down for a final few words.
Do not grieve. You will be going with us sooner than you think.
Sooner than you think.
While most of the crowd was watching the spectacle and vicariously riding with the warriors, Badger Boy returned to his teepee. He picked up the items he had laid out, his bow, his quiver and arrows, a leather lariat, and a supply of dried meat sufficient to last him many days, provided he did not eat much. He slipped out the backside where the bottom of the buffalo hide covering had been rolled up to allow circulation of air at ground level. He glanced around quickly to be sure no one had seen him, then trotted toward the horse herd. He stopped twice, turning to look back, making sure he was not followed by anyone who might try to stop him. He could still see the teepee he shared with his brother. He feared he might not share it much longer, for Steele's the ponies had taken a strong fancy to a young woman of the village. He was talking about marrying her when he returned from the raid, for he was confident he would bring back many horses. Her father would be pleased to accept a new son-in-law who brought him many horses. Badger Boy did not see why a man needed a wife. From observation, he was aware that a man had physical need for a woman, but he knew a woman's favors were not difficult to obtain for one honored as a warrior. He had awakened many times deep in the night to find that a young woman had voluntarily entered the teepee and joined his brother upon his blankets. A man didn't have to marry. He didn't have to put his brother out of the teepee just so he could bring in a woman to stay. However, since that appeared to be the probable outcome, and Badger Boy would soon be living alone, or perhaps sharing with other youths too young to ponder marriage, it seemed all the more appropriate that he be allowed to participate in the raid. And if he could not have his brother's approval, he would go without it. He had planned this for some time. For several days, he had slipped out before full daylight and studied the horse herd. He had found that most horses formed habits of behavior. At night, each had its own place to sleep within the group. Though the herd was moved frequently from one area to another for fresh grass, daylight would find each animal in more or less the same location relative to the others. Steele's the ponies had taken his best warhorse with him, but Badger Boy had long thought his brother might be overlooking the merits of a particular roan he had brought back from an earlier foray. This roan could usually be found near the perimeter of the herd each morning, on the north side, near two other geldings with which it had formed a bond. Stealthily, like the wolf, Badger Boy had practiced slipping among the horses and catching the roan without stirring up the rest of the herd or the two sleepy-eyed boys who stood night watch. So far, he had not been caught. He did not plan to be caught today. The roan had become accustomed to Badger Boy's morning routine. It pointed its ears toward him as he approached, but showed no sign of concern. Badger Boy quickly had one arm around the horse's neck and fitted a rawhide bridle over its head. Though surprised, the roan did not resist or try to turn away. Badger Boy held still a minute, making sure where the two night guards were. He located both on the far side, paying no attention that he could see. He felt sure one was asleep, and the other was not far from it. He led the roan to the edge of the herd in a slow walk. He kept looking back over his shoulder, trying to keep the roan between him and the two guards so they would not easily spot him if they should happen to look in his direction. Only when he had reached a stand of small timber did he begin to breathe easily. Only then could he feel confident that he was getting away with his plan. He had reconciled himself to the certainty that Steele's the ponies would be unhappy with him. He knew he was probably in for verbal and perhaps even physical abuse at his brother's hands and from his brother's companions. But by the time they saw him and knew what he had done, it would be too late to send him back. He planned to follow unseen until they were in the settlements. From that point, Steele's the ponies would see that it was safer for him to remain with the warrior than to try to find his way back alone through the white man's country. He mounted bareback, his bow and quiver and the lariat slung over his shoulder. He wore no decoration, no feather in his hair, for he had not yet earned the right. He had not yet been on the customary vision quest, during which a young man waited for a guardian spirit to visit him, to endow him with the medicine that would guide him on his life's journey. He had asked the shaman to advise him, but the shaman had said he did not yet have enough years to seek power. His first impulse was to ride hard and get himself some distance away from the village in case someone should miss him and come to fetch him back. But who was likely to miss him? If he rode too fast, he might overtake his brother and the war party prematurely. He would almost surely suffer punishment for his transgression, then be sent back, shamed. Steals the Ponies had always counseled him that patience was essential, that haste too often led a warrior to a downfall. Though Badger Boy itched to move with more speed, he slowed his pace once he felt he was well clear of the village and any strong likelihood that someone would come after him. He knew Steals the Ponies and the others would not push their horses hard and risk wearing them down. The time to push would be on the return, when there was likely to be pursuit. In the beginning, the trail was easy to follow. The riders made no effort to conceal it, for here in the heart of the Comancheria there was no enemy to elude. He knew that as they moved closer to the settlements, the tracks would challenge him. Fortunately, his brother had taught him much about trailing, whether it be for game or for enemies. Badger Boy sometimes boasted that Steals the Ponies could trace the shadow of a hawk across bare rock. For 3 days, the trail led southward. Badger Boy began to wonder if his brother might have changed his mind about the Texan settlements and be heading for Mexico instead. He was disappointed, for he had much more curiosity about the Texans than about Mexico. However, the fourth day, the trail abruptly shifted eastward. His brother's strategy became clear. He had remained well west of the settlements until he had led his fighters as far south as they needed to go. Now they were riding directly toward the Texans' farms. Badger Boy found anticipation exhilarating. The first log cabin stopped him cold. He tied the roan on the far side of a small hill out of sight, then lay on his belly in grass atop the hill. He studied the farm with an insistent curiosity. The sight prompted fleeting memories, so quickly come and gone that he could not quite grasp them and hold them for inspection. He vaguely remembered that he had lived in such a cabin once, not much different from the one he observed now. He remembered playing in the yard, riding a long stick and pretending it was a horse. He could almost see a man and a woman in his mind's eye, but they were as elusive as the other memories. Hard as he tried, he could not bring them into focus. Perhaps it was just as well. That was another life, gone forever. He had attuned himself to a different life among the people. Those others, whoever they might have been, were strangers to him. The spirits probably preferred that they remain so. He saw a wagon standing empty beside a shed. He remembered riding on one long ago. It had to have been before his time with the Comanches, for he had never seen a wagon since Buffalo Caller had taken him. He had seen no Texans either, except a couple of captives. One had been a boy younger than himself, kept to raise by another band. The other had been a woman. The last he had seen of her, some warriors were dragging her away. He could only imagine what had become of her. He remembered being strangely affected by her screams as if he had heard them before. A wizened old grandmother had warned him not to show concern, for unwarranted sympathy might mark him unfit to be trained as a fighting man. Nothing that happened to a Texan woman could ever be punishment enough for injuries the Texans had done to the people, she said. He studied the wagon a long time, wishing he might ride in it. Then perhaps he could summon a clearer memory of the last time. He noted that the wagon had 4 wheels. He had seen ox-drawn carts with 2 big wheels, brought out onto the plains by Mexican Comanchero traders from somewhere west. In them, they brought all manner of fascinating trading goods. Later, they would return to wherever they came from, the trade goods exchanged for cattle, horses, and especially mules the warriors had taken from the Texan settlements. Comanches had little use for mules, considering them much inferior to the horse, but they had found them valuable for trading. He understood that the Mexicans did not like the Texans. Steals the Ponies said they had warred, and the Texans had won. He wished he could have seen the fight. It was claimed that they had great guns many times larger than the rifle for which Steals the Pony had once traded a horse and 3 mules to the Comancheros. It was said these guns made a noise louder than thunder. That was hard for Badger Boy to imagine. He saw a woman come out into an open passageway between the 2 sides of the cabin, her long hair flowing in the wind. At the distance, he had no idea if she were young or old, but something about her gave him pause, stirred unexpected feelings he could not understand. Curiosity would have carried him closer for a better look, but caution won out. In a field some distance beyond the cabin, he could see a farmer at work. It was likely he had a rifle that could kill or wound at a much greater distance than Badger Boy's bows and arrows. The raiders had made their trail much more difficult to follow once they reached the edge of the settled country. But Badger Boy knew they had passed this way. More than likely, his brother had marked this place to be struck on the return journey. Then perhaps Badger Boy would get a closer look. He eased down the far side of the hill and remounted the roan. His mind turned back to the cabin and the people who lived there. He tried to reconcile them with fleeting wisps of memory that had long haunted him, tiny fragments of a past life. An uneasy feeling came upon him. He had long recognized that he had strong instincts, premonitions about things not yet seen. Even forewarned, he almost rode up on a man and a boy in a wagon. Badger Boy saw them at about the same time they discovered him. His heart leaped.
Oh, no.
Dust kicked up where the shot fell short. Fortunately, Badger Boy was out of range. He hoped the man only had his shotgun. Never before had anyone attempted to kill him. He found himself sweating, his mouth dry. Warriors were not supposed to know fear, but Badger Boy was afraid. He looked back, thinking the man might come after him. He realized the wagon made pursuit difficult, for the roan could travel where wheels could not. He began to get a grip on his nerves, though he still felt as if his thumping heart had risen high in his chest, almost in his throat. Steele's the ponies would be ashamed of him. He was ashamed of himself. Later, when he had time to gather his wits, he realized he had made a mistake that could endanger the raiders. By allowing himself to be seen, he might have started an alarm that would move more quickly than the warriors. The Texans might be ready and waiting. He was so weighted down with anxiety and remorse that he allowed himself to become careless again.
Not again.
He kept staring straight ahead, keeping his head down in case those chasing him had rifles. But he knew they were catching up to him.
Brother?
Badger Boy reeled his horse to a stop, too quickly as it turned out.
Badger Boy? Why are you here?
He looked into the furious eyes of Steele's the ponies. He could not find a voice to speak.
What are you doing here?
I wanted to ride with you.
I told you many times, you cannot.
Tonkawa Killer pushed up close, a quirt in his hand, fury in his face.
Do you not know you have endangered us all? What if you had been seen?
Badger Boy started to sweat. He would rather take a beating than admit what he had done. But to hold his silence would be the same as lying.
I was. A man shot at me.
You are a fool!
The man grabbed for his quirt.
Listen to you. You cannot even bear punishment. How are you supposed to be one of us?
That's enough, Tonkawa Killer. We cannot undo what has been done.
He is not one of us. He has the pale skin of a Texan, and he always will.
Badger Boy fought against a rising of tears. He looked into his brother's eyes, searching for signs of forgiveness, but finding none.
Some of us may be killed because of your recklessness. Now we have to decide whether to go ahead or turn back.
Go back without horses? The village would laugh at us.
But that is better than hearing the women cry, because some of us do not come back at all.
Well, perhaps you should take your Texan baby back to the village. I will lead however many want to continue the raid.
Steele's the ponies had to concede the obvious, that most were not ready to give up what they had begun. They had invested too many days and nights already.
Either we all go back, or we all go ahead. I can see that most of you want to go ahead, so that is what we will do.
What about that boy? He may already have spoiled our medicine. We cannot take him.
We have no choice. We are too far into the Texan country to send him back alone.
Give me a chance to fight. I will do whatever you say.
Yes, you will. Or I will let Tonkawa Killer wear out his quirt on your back.
His back already burned severely. Though he could not see it, Badger Boy sensed that the quirt had cut deeply enough to bring blood. He had been willing to shed blood on this raid, but he would have expected it to result from battle, not from punishment. Shame made him realize how small he really was, how badly out of place here among men who had proven their maturity and earned the right to go against the Texans. Steele's the ponies frowned at him, then looked at the roan.
You are disobedient, and you are foolish, but at least you have good judgment about horses.
That was small comfort, but even a grudging compliment was welcome in the face of so much blame. Badger Boy made it a point to ride close to his brother, and as far as possible from Tonkawa Killer.